Tonight we're ready to look at the Olivet Discourse, and we may get into the first arrest of Christ. But basically we've come last week from Matthew 21, 22, and 23, and it focused on the fact that coming up to Matthew 24, we have a dual rejection. This is the setting for the Olivet Discourse. And the dual rejection has been, number one, the rejection of the king by the nation. And that is focused on and dealt with in Matthew 21, 22, and 22. That starts with the triumphal entry when Christ comes into Jerusalem and the people of the leaders will formally reject him. Upon the rejection of the king turns around and rejects the people or the nation. And that is in chapter 23. And when you come to chapter 24, the thrust is the rejected king begins to make predictions. And that is 24. And that is tonight where we want to look and where we want to what we want to develop. However, in looking at Matthew 24, let me say that there are two basic ways that this gets interpreted. Some look at Matthew 24 and they say most is already fulfilled. There isn't much that's future there. And those that do that will say the key verse is Matthew 24, verse 34. Verse 34 reads, "Truly I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place." And they will outline this way, is that everything is past in Matthew 24, 1 through 33. Then you go to the linking verse, and everything from Matthew 24, 34 to the 35 to the end is future. That is saying that the majority of Matthew chapter 24 has already been fulfilled, and we don't look forward to any future fulfillment. For example, if you come down to 24, verse 5, "Many will come in my name saying, I am the Christ, and will mislead many." We ought to look at that as having already been fulfilled in time past. Verse 6, "You will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars. See that you're not frightened, for these things must take place, but that is not yet the end." And they will say, that has already occurred. Verse 7, "Nation will rise against nation." And they will say, that has already occurred. Now, the fact that I think this is a wrong interpretation is evidenced by the following. Let me give you one commentator who talks about the fact that verses 29 through 31 have already been fulfilled. Let me read his interpretation and see if you see what's wrong with it. Verse 29. "Immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light, and the stars will fall from the sky, and the powers of heaven shall be shaken," and so forth and so forth. And by this man's interpretation, he says the following. And see if you can catch the error of it. If the sun, moon, and stars refer to the Jewish nation and its prerogatives, then we have seen the fulfillment of this prophecy. The Jewish nation has been darkened and no longer shines for God. This has been true ever since the tribulation of those days. The sun of Judaism has been darkened. As to the moon, it no longer reflects the light of God. Bright stars, as were the prophets, no longer shine in the Israel of the flesh. Do you have any problem with that interpretation? If so, what? It totally spiritualizes, doesn't it? It makes the prophets the stars? Made the prophets the stars, and therefore any interpretation that goes this way, and this was from the way this man had, Marcellus Kick, his name, had interpreted the passage, and we have to take that as wrong because it forces us to allegorize and not take the passage in its literal sense. So we're going to take Matthew 24, and I think our position will be it's most unfulfilled. And now we'll outline it with number one, Roman numeral one, the setting. for the Olivet Discourse. Chapter 24, verses 1 and 2. The setting. Verse 1, remember Jesus' triumphal entry. He's been in the temple. And now in verse 1, Jesus came out from the temple and was going away when the disciples came up to point out the temple buildings to him. And he answered and said, "Do you not see all these things? Truly I say to you, not one stone here shall be left upon another which shall not be torn down." In other words, he is predicting the physical destruction of the temple and of Jerusalem. But in getting the setting, the context goes clear back to some things he had said, three things basically, that he had said back at the end of chapter 23. And let's go back to that. He had made three big statements. If we miss any of them, we'll miss everything in Matthew 24, I'm convinced. The first thing he had said was this: the blood of all the prophets is going to be avenged on this generation. The blood of all the prophets is going to be avenged on you. On this particular generation, reading in 23, verse 35, speaking to the scribes, he says, "That upon you may fall the guilt of all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of the righteous Abel to the blood of Zechariah, the son of Barachai, whom you murdered between the temple and the altar." In other words, he says, I'm going to take all of the history of Israel that is strewn with the death of prophets that you have stoned and the blood you have shed, and I'm going to concentrate all of the judgment on this generation. Strong statement. The second thing he has said is in verse 37 and 38, he is going to say that the nation is to be forsaken. Judgment on it, and it is to be forsaken. And that he spelled out in chapter 23, verse 37. O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets, stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together, the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate. So with those two points, it's all dark. However, he makes a third point. And the third point which he makes is a future for Israel still remains. A future still remains. And that is found in verse 39. They're going to be forsaken. And if you ended with verse 38, you could very easily say, well, I guess that's the last chapter. But verse 39 is written to say, the nation forsaken and judged is not the last chapter. There is another chapter yet to be written. Verse 39. For I say to you, from now on you shall not see me until. And that's saying it's not over. There is an until. Until you say, quote, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. And so the future that is involved is simply saying by the word until that the condition is not permanent. You have rejected your king. You will not always reject your king. Your king has rejected you, but he will not always reject you. The condition is not permanent. Now, had you been one of the disciples, what kind of questions would you have on your mind when he said that? Our nation is going to be destroyed. It's going to be judged. It's going to be forsaken. The temple is going to be in rubble. And yet, that is going to happen until the king comes back again and we receive him as a nation. What kind of questions would you have? Well, they were basically filled with two kinds of questions. And they both centered around that little word, until. And the questions were when and how questions. When is this going to happen? And how will we know that it's near? And basically in Matthew 24, that's what Jesus is going to teach about. He is going to talk about the fact that there will be a time when he will come back. He's going to depart in the interim until. And they are going to say, well, when are you going to come back again? And is there any way that we can know? How will we be able to determine when this is going to take place? And his response is answer to those questions. All right, after the setting, now look at the questions that they're going to ask. And the questions are in 24 and verse 3. In verse 3, note there are two questions, not three. Let's read it as though it were three and then show why that is not true. And as he was sitting on the Mount of Olives, the disciples came to him privately saying, "Tell us, when will these things be?" See the kind of question they got on their minds? "And what will be the sign of your coming?" And third question, "What will be the sign of the end of the age?" Now that's not the way it is. It's only two questions. When you see the last part, well, let me just narrate the questions. The first one is this: "Tell us, when will these things be?" Second question: "What will be the sign of your coming, even the end of the age?" And the Greek is put together in such a way that the word "coming" and the end of the age are coterminous. They happen at the same time. So they have two questions in mind, and they all both arise from that indefinite period of time that the Lord had put in the end of chapter 23. They rise from the indefinite period of time that the Lord had put between forsaking the nation and return. This is what they want to know about. You're going to forsake the nation, you're going away, you're going to come again, and you're going to remain there until your return. And we want to know something about this period of time. We want to know the what's and the how's and the why's of it. And this is the question that the disciples are answering. And we want to note that the Lord will give to this a very clear-cut answer. In fact, notice that the answer is long. It starts in 24, verse 4, and it goes clear through the end of chapter 25. And notice there's a lot of detail in it. So, question in verse 3 and verse 4, "And Jesus answered and said to them," and he begins to give the answer. And the answer will come really in two parts. The first thing he will give will be a general event answer. Very broad things that are going to happen, and that is in verses 4 through 14. Then in verse 15, he gets very specific. And that continues 15 down through verse 31. Then at that point, he's going to pick up his parabolic teaching, and we'll have a series of parables that come along at that point. What the disciples had done at this point is they had developed in their minds a chronology of events. They naturally would. They had probably been thinking about it a lot. The Lord had announced that he was going to depart. He would be back again, and certain things would happen, and they would naturally want to put those things together. That's the way the human mind works. When you have a series of things that are going to happen, you kind of like to know what's going to be first. What are you going to do next? Then when you do that, what's going to happen then? And basically, they had a chronology in their mind, and the chronology involved, number one, his departure. The upper room discourse has made that clear. The king is leaving. He's going back to heaven. They knew a few of the things he was going to do. He was going to go back and prepare a place for them. They knew that. They also know that after the departure of the king, there is going to be a time period. Third, from Matthew 24, verse 2, they knew the temple and the city were going to be destroyed. They knew that was coming. Lord had predicted that very, very clearly. And then they knew, number four, that the king would return. Now, basically, what the Lord is going to teach them is to teach them that the major time period you need to understand is there's going to be time right here between the destruction of Jerusalem and the return of the king. We can look backwards and we know the city was destroyed in 70 AD and the return of the king is yet future. But this is the thing that makes Matthew 24 interesting, is that how future is the return of the king? and how future it is, we can have some handle on. We certainly cannot set dates, but we can get a little handle on what are the events that will precede this, what will be the trends, and the things that will take place in society in terms of prior to the Lord's return. However, before he does that, he gives them a warning. In fact, we might say the warning is part of his answer. And the warning comes in 24, 4 through 6. The warning is designed to show that there is going to be a period of time between the destruction of Jerusalem and his second coming or his return. So verse 4. Jesus answered and said to him, "Be careful. See to it." And by the way, in all of the accounts, they all have this warning. The "see to it." Be careful that no one misleads you. And what that does is to point out that there will be a lot of deception about the Lord's return. And the deception comes from two places. Number one, it comes from people. And that is in verse 5. There will be a lot of deception coming out of the mouth of people about his return. So verse 5. "For many will come in my name, saying, 'I am the Messiah,' and will mislead many." So there will be certain people that will come along. We might take a look at one of them, Acts 5. Acts 5. Before we get through the book of Acts, there is already a record of Messiah's coming, gathering a group of people around them. Acts 5:36. Gamaliel observes that Israel has been the victim of many a Messiah, and he names a couple of them here. Verse 36, he says, "Some time ago, Theudas rose up, claiming to be somebody, and a group of about 400 men joined up with him, and he was slain. And all who followed him were dispersed and came to nothing." One of the false messiahs. Next, "After this man, Judas of Galilee rose up in the days of the sentence and drew away some people after him. He too perished, and all those who followed him were scattered." And so just exactly what the Lord predicts is, keep in mind, there is going to be great deception. There are going to people come along, and they're going to deceive you. Second will be the deception that comes from events. This ought to be important because very often in verses 6 and 7, he is giving, notice he's giving them things that will avoid them being misled. That's the theme in verse 4. I don't want you to be misled about my coming. And people will do it, and people's interpretation of events will do it. And how many have been misled by this, someone using this verse? "And you will be hearing of wars and rumors of wars." I guess we would call that Cold War. "You will hear of wars and Cold War. See that you are not frightened, for these things must take place, but that is not yet the end." And how often during World War II was this the war? Or Mussolini was the Antichrist, Hitler was the Antichrist, and many, many people were misled by that. And therefore, he's simply saying that the deception in the area of prophecy is very, very possible, and you got to realize, coming down to verse 6, that these things must take place. In other words, they're part of the fabric of human history. Now, with that, he then begins to turn to a general description of the end time. General description or general events that we can look on and say these are things that are indicative of the Lord's return. So we begin in verse 7. "For nation will rise against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and in various places there will be famines and earthquakes." Now, the thing to note is what is different between verses 6 and 7. I take it the difference between verses 6 and 7 is verse 6 talks about relatively local situations. an outbreak here, an outbreak there, a cold war. That does not indicate the end times. That is part of history. The seventh verse, we might put it this way, verse 6 is typical history. Verse 7 is last day history. And notice what is involved in last day events. Number one, international tension. I think that is very much the stress that is there, that this is not local. This is on an international level. It is nation against nation, kingdom against kingdom, and that is one of the trends of the last days. Question, how much international tension? And what kind of answer can you get from the text? You can't. We don't know. Except to say, treat these things as trends. International tension is the first. Second indication of the last days, or the beginning of the last days, will be in various places there will be famines and earthquakes. So international tensions is first, and then you have the physical world, convulsions in the physical world. And they are two, basically. They are geographical, expressed by the earthquakes, and they are famines, or they are agricultural. And again, you could ask out of verse 7, how many famines does it take to fulfill this verse? How many earthquakes does it take to fulfill this verse? And the answer is, we do not know. He is speaking about trends. And therefore, the way I would think to interpret whether or not these things are beginning to come about is to simply say, how many of these trends are present? If you simply have international tension, but none of the others, then you'd want to go light on it. And therefore, in interpreting, are we in the last days? Is there international tension? Are the phenomena he described in the physical world, are they increasing? Geological. Geological. Earthquakes, and then agricultural would have to do with your famines. Third, verses 9 and 10, they will deliver you up to tribulation and will kill you. You will be hated by all nations on account of my name. And so here again, an international starts all of these things. These are international, worldwide events. There will be worldwide hostility toward Christ. Worldwide hostility toward Christ. Third, or fourth, that does not mean that there will be no religion, however, because notice in verse 11, many false prophets will rise and mislead many, and therefore you have also an abundance of religion. Lots of religion, much hostility toward Christ, upheavals in the physical world in terms of agriculture and geology with the famine and earthquakes, international tension. Next, you have an abundance of relativism. Relativism would simply mean that everybody does their own thing. And you have that coming down in verse 12. It says lawlessness. Lawlessness is simply the failure to recognize any absolutes. There are none. We do what we wish. And most people's love will grow cold. And then finally, you have in the midst of all of this, thankfully, a witness to the truth. And that is spelled out in verse 14. This gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world. Notice the international flavor? This is all worldwide. The gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in the whole world for a witness to all nations, and then shall the end come. So, notice, the witness to the truth is going to do three things. The witness to the truth will, number one, provide opportunity. This is a picture of God's grace extended before judgment. God will give an opportunity by the preaching of the truth before judgment. Principle, grace always precedes judgment. God always gives that little extra opportunity. And so before the judgment occurs, you have the opportunity, and that's a principle all the way through. The preaching of the gospel will provide opportunity. Second, it will cause many to come to faith. And third, for those that do not, it will establish a basis for judgment. You can't say you weren't given opportunity. You can't say God was not fair. You can't say you didn't hear. You can't plead ignorance. And this is God's last, final dealing with humanity before the judgment of the last times takes place. Now, with this, he then becomes very specific. And I said specific events. I ought to say this, specific event, really. And the specific event is in 15 through 22. Verse 15, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet, standing in the holy place, then get in gear and move to the mountains, because the end is very, very near. So, let's say something, first of all, about the term. The term, abomination of desolation, as Jesus teaches, comes out of Daniel. It comes from Daniel 9:27, Daniel 11:31, and Daniel 12:11. And in the prophecy of Daniel, and let's go to it, in the prophecy of Daniel, chapter 9, you have three important things. Jesus is very clearly referring to Daniel 9. He says so. Notice the prophecy there, Daniel chapter 9. Verses 25 and following. There are three important elements in understanding this prophecy of Daniel, and the first one is the decree. This is a section of three verses where the Lord, through the prophet Daniel, is going to tell Israel, you can know to the day when the Messiah is coming. We often think, and I think we do it by transferring, that because we can't know the time of the second coming, that they couldn't know the time of the first coming, and that's not true. Daniel makes it very clear, I can give you just exactly to the day when the Messiah is coming. Had this prophecy been fully believed, Jesus would have been recognized. All right, first of all, the decree. Verse 25, so you are to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until Messiah, the Prince, there will be, and then he gives how much time. So notice it's a time prophecy. The important thing is what is its beginning point? It starts out with the decree. There are three possible decrees that had to do with the building of rebuilding of Jerusalem. The first one was the one to Cyrus, or one made by Cyrus, and it's found in Ezra 1, 2 through 4. The second one was made by Darius, and that is found in Ezra, same book, 6, 3 through 8. And then there is a third one made by Artaxerxes in Nehemiah. And the one in Nehemiah is in 2, 1 through 8. Now, the problem is, which one is he referring to? And I think we can safely circle the one issued by Artaxerxes, for the simple reason is that that is the only one that deals directly with rebuilding the city. In other words, it's the only one that really fulfills precisely the fact that it was the decree to rebuild Jerusalem. Why wouldn't the one to Cyrus fit? It was the decree that said, do you want to go back and rebuild a city? You can go back. It had to do with the people. So did the one under Darius. This one has to do with the city. That, therefore, in turn, can be dated. It can be dated 445 B.C. On the basis of that, then, you can begin to put down a little chronology, and we'll put the first point as the decree of Artaxerxes in 445, and then you can proceed to count down for 69 weeks of years. And from that point on, it is 173,880 days. Follow. And as Sir Robert Anderson clearly establishes, that last day terminated at the triumphal entry. On the triumphal entry, the Lord gives some very emphatic words. He looks at Jerusalem and says, on this your day, which will be right. And again, if you want the figures on this, this is based on a prophetic year, which is 360 days. And you take in leap years and so forth if you have a leaning toward that and want to see all the figures and the facts and the way he deals with it, it's available. I'll get it for you. But these two things we have coming down to this point. So the decree is the first thing to establish. The second thing after the decree is to say something about the weeks themselves. And it is said to be 69 weeks of years. And so what you're really doing, if we would translate that over into years, from the decree of Artaxerxes to the coming of the Messiah is 483 years. Now look at Daniel once again. Verse 25, so you to know and discern that from the issuing of a decree to restore and build Jerusalem until Messiah Prince, there will be 7 weeks and 62 weeks or 69 weeks or 483 years. It will be built again with plaza and moat even in times of distress. Then after the 62 weeks, the Messiah will be cut off. And so we know that after the triumphal entry, what happens? The Messiah gets cut off or the cross. And as we know from looking back at it, that was very quickly after the fulfillment of this period, was it not? Just a matter of days, and that's what we're ready to begin looking at in the study of the life of Christ. Then, notice in verse 27, you have left off at the end 1 week, or 7 years. And what happens then? Well, this prince comes along, verse 27, and he makes a firm covenant with the many for 1 week. But in the middle of the week, he will put a stop to the sacrifice and grain offering, and on the wing of abominations will come one who makes desolate. And therefore, in the middle of it, you have what is called by Jesus the abomination of desolation. And over here, of course, you have his return, second coming. So what is the first event that is to indicate the second coming of Christ? The first event has to do with this abomination of desolation. So let's go back then to Matthew 24. Verse 15, he says, therefore, when you see the abomination of desolation, which is again 3.5 years before the return of the Lord, which was spoken of through Daniel the prophet standing in the holy place, let the reader understand. Then this is going to indicate the end is coming fast. So he therefore says, let those who are in Judea flee to the mountains. Let him who was on the housetop not go down to get the things out of the house. Let him who's in the field not turn back, and so forth down through the context. With that, he then talks about our next part, or the coming of the Son of Man. Jesus' coming, or his return. And that's in 23:29. And he's going to talk about his return two ways. Negatively, what it will not be. It will not be obscure. And notice that thrust. Verse 23 says, then if anyone says to you, behold, here is the Christ, there he is, don't believe him. For false prophets, false Christs will arise and will show great signs and wonders, so as to mislead, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I have told you in advance. If therefore they say to you, behold, he's in the wilderness, don't go forth. Behold, he's in the inner rooms, do not believe him. In other words, all of these instances have one common point. They say that the appearance of the Messiah has to be pointed out. And he's going to say, if it has to be pointed out, that isn't it. So positively, what is it? On the positive side, it will be very, very obvious. And that is found in verse 27. For just as the lightning comes from the east, if you're sitting outside and lightning crosses the sky, does someone have to say to you, did you see it? There's lightning up there. Lightning manifests itself very clearly. So like a flash of lightning, even so shall the coming of the Son of Man be. Then he drops in a little proverb here. Wherever the corpse is, there the vultures will gather. And I'll admit that's hard to interpret. I take it that the vultures must refer back in context to all these false messiahs that have been in verses 25 and 26. And the corpse perhaps refers to the nation of Israel. And therefore, here's the corpse, the dead nation, and all these vultures are gathered around the corpse is probably what he means. Then in 29 and so forth, you have the miracles that are involved. And notice he then turns to parabolic teaching. And the parabolic teaching starts in 24:32 on down through 25:30. And basically, they all revolve off of the first one. They all revolve off of the parable of the fig tree. And it's a simple one. Verse 32. Learn the parable from the fig tree. When its branch has already become tender, puts forth its leaves, you know that the summer is near. Remember, on every parable, we always ask, what is its main point? And the point of this is very simple. When the signs come, or when the signs begin, it won't be long. It will be rapid. When the signs begin, it will be rapid. It will happen very, verily, very quickly. Now, problem of interpretation. When we come down to verse 34, what does this mean? Truly I say to you, this generation shall not pass away until all these things take place. So, a problem that we want to deal with is what does he mean by this generation? And let me give several ways it's been taken, and then I'll give the correct view, which is my view. What does he mean by this generation? The first possibility is he's talking about his contemporaries. If he's talking about his contemporaries, then we've got to find everything in Matthew 24 as already fulfilled in the first century. And if you interpret that way, if he means the people that are literally standing right here are going to see all of these things happen, then you've got some real problems, and you're going to have to allegorize. I cannot buy that that is what it means. Second interpretation is given to you in your New American Standard Version, because you have what down in that verse, I believe? Or is it in the margin? It's in the margin, isn't it? If you've got New American Standard Version, truly I see this generation, don't you have a one by that? And if you trace that one out into the margin, they will put race. And therefore, that means that he's talking about the Jewish race. And it is true. That word translated generation can be translated race. So he's simply saying that they'll never wipe out the Jew. They will endure. That interpretation is okay. I don't really think it's the right one. The second one, or the third one, is you put stress on the word to take place. Truly, this generation will not pass away until all these things take place. The verb takes place, genomai, literally means begin. And that's true, it does mean that. means begin. And therefore, they will say, well, what this passage is teaching, that the people standing there are going to see the beginning of this happen. And it will go on, and they may die, but they'll see the beginning of it. Can you see the flaw of that interpretation? Truly, truly, I say to you, this generation will not pass away until all these things begin to take place. There's one that just, one little phrase in there that's completely overlooks. This generation will not pass away until what? All these things begin to take place. In other words, that would demand that they would have to see the beginning of everything in Matthew 24. A fourth interpretation that gets the big star is the one that simply says this refers to the generation that will be existing when these things start. The generation to exist when the signs start. In other words, if the first of these signs begins, the generation that sees them, things will go so fast that they will see it all happen. In other words, they will not die until they have been fulfilled. And as we look at the book of Revelation, the very beginning verse, he talks about, I'm going to tell you things that must quickly come to pass. And the word quickly there means in rapid succession. Once they start, it will be very, very rapid. It won't be protracted over a long period of time. Now, notice, coming down to the next verse, heaven and earth will pass away, but my word shall not pass away. But of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels of heaven, nor the Son, but the Father alone. Now, what do we usually take verse 36 to teach? What you say, it's usually the stress. It's usually the stress in verse 36 that this teaches the peril of date setting. You can't set dates. Well, that is not what that verse means. That's true, we can't set dates. But the fact that we do not know the day and hour does not merely mean we can't set dates. The fact that we do not know the day and hour, what does he make of that? You don't know the date or hour, so you better what? Be ready. That's the lesson that's made of it. And notice that comes out down in the following context. If you look down at verse 42. Therefore, be on the alert. Why? For you do not know which day your Lord is coming. And while we as believers anticipate the shout, we don't know when it could be. I might not get out this whole sentence. We do not know. It could happen at any moment. We may not get home tonight. We do not know. And that is called in 1 John the purifying hope. When company is imminent, things really move around the house, don't they? When it gets so close to a certain time, you can't walk across the living room because it's been swept from north to south, and you'll leave footprints. Any of you live with someone like that? I try to be cooperative, but that's one thing I can't hack. I just can't do that. I can't walk across my living room. I love to get my Adidas shoes on that have got little nubs on the bottom. Pomp all over like you've been playing basketball in the front room. So the stress coming down here, since we do not know, this stresses up. We should be ready at all times. And all of the parables are going to teach that. For example, look at verse 43 and 44. He says, be sure of this, that if the head of the house had known at what time in the night the thief was coming, he would have been on the alert and would have not allowed his house to be broken into. For this reason, you be ready too. For the Son of Man is coming in an hour when you think, when you do not think he will. That's the stress of all of these parables. Be ready. Look at verse 45. Who then is the faithful and sensible slave whom his master put in charge of his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that slave whom his master finds in so doing when he comes. Truly I say unto you, he will put him in charge of all of his possessions. But if that evil slave says in his heart, my master is not coming for a long time, Then he shall beat his fellow slaves, and he will eat with and drink with the drunkards. The master of the slave will come on a day when he does not expect him, and an hour when he does not know, and shall cut him in pieces and assign him a place with the hypocrites. Weeping shall there be and gnashing of teeth. And that essentially continues with the parables that all say, since you do not know when he is coming, we must be ready. All right, I've got just time enough to do a little setting for what we're going to do next. We have covered in time past the trial and death of Christ. And when that is the case, I like to take all of my past material and lock it up and start fresh. And therefore, I started fresh yesterday in terms of trying to get a good glimpse of the trial and death of Christ. Whenever we study the death of Christ, you've always got to decide, where do we begin? Where do we start it? And of the many, many lives of Christ, they start different places. Some of them start with the triumphal entry and say that is the beginning of the end. And that's true. It certainly is. In other words, they start at the time when Jesus was formally presented and formally rejected and move on from that point. Others study the death of Christ starting with foot washing in the upper room, and that's a good place to start. Others will start in Gethsemane. I have decided to go a little different route, and on our next study at 10 o'clock on Sunday morning, we're going to start with his arrest. And the thing that marks that off as unique is we will start at the time when Jesus is deprived of the freedom to move about. And therefore, we will start, therefore, with that particular passage. And the scene is going to be very vivid. The scene will be midnight. We will be at the gate of Gethsemane, and the moon will be full. And what we will see is that just as you go outside of the city of Jerusalem, both then as well as now, both now as well as then, as soon as you go outside of the eastern wall of Jerusalem, the land slopes down just a short distance, probably 5 to 6 minutes walking time, right down to the brook Kedron. And across Kedron, the Mount of Olives begins to rise. And in those times, over that eastern slope of the Mount of Olives were many, many, many gardens planted and many vineyards. One of those vineyards will be Gethsemane. And as the agony of the garden is past, we're going to see Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, and we'll look back across Kedron on up the tiny slope, and we will see leading several hundred people, Judas. And Judas will come down with the arresting crowd, and you will have the Roman soldiers, you will have Judas in the leadership, you will have the temple police, you will have what John is going to call a Roman band, or a spera. A spera was a technical term for 600 Roman armed soldiers. There are times, however, when that spera was used for what they called a maniple, and when it was used that way, it was 200 armed soldiers. So 2 or 600. You have this mass of people coming out, and at this point, you will have the arrest of Jesus, and that's where we'll begin in our next study in the life of Christ, and move from there through and see the horribleness of the sin of Judas. I had an interesting comment I was going to quote tonight. Stalker has done a good job on the trial and death of Christ. And at this first arrest of Jesus, Peter gets in there and gets the sword and cuts off Malchus' ear. He's going to protect the Lord. And the Lord puts it back on. And Stalker makes a good comment. He says, quote, "How much better if Peter had drawn a spiritual sword and cut off his own ear, which was soon to be betrayed by a little servant girl's taunt." And therefore, from that point on, Jesus will say, "This is the hour of the power of darkness." And we'll pick up with that point in our next study in the life of Christ. Father, we're thankful for your word. We're thankful for the certainty of your return. We're thankful that tonight the trumpet could blast and we could be caught up to meet you in the air and so dwell with you forever. We pray in the meantime that we will get our house and keep it clean and recognize that the King could come anytime. In his name,